The following was originally produced for the national radio series Focus on the Family, featuring psychologist and best-selling author Dr. James Dobson. On this cassette, we feature a conversation between Dr. Dobson and his special guests, Dr. David Hocking and his wife, Carol. Dr. and Mrs. Hocking are the authors of the book Romantic Lovers, The Intimate Marriage, and that book was the topic for the studio conversation, as Focus on the Family co-host Mike Trout gets the program underway.
Well, Doctor, this should be a fun day. We have a man of many talents here in the studio with us, along with his wife. He's an author and a fellow broadcaster and a pastor, so it should be a fun day. And you've got a book that they've just written.
I sure do, Mike. The name of it is Romantic Lovers, The Intimate Marriage by Dr. David and Carol Hocking. Dr. Hocking's voice will be very familiar to our listeners, I'm sure, from across the country. They hear him on the Biola Hour every day. He's also pastor of Calvary Church in Santa Ana, one of the most dynamic and successful churches, evangelical churches in America today. David and Carol have been friends of ours for some time, and we're delighted to welcome you to our studio.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. It's good to be with you. Although, hearing that introduction, I doubt seriously you got the right person.
Well, I'm not through. I got four more pages. You provided the material. What am I going to do?
I did. Oh, my goodness.
I want to ask you all a question right here at the top of the program. Mm-hmm. You've been married for 24 years. This is the 25th. How did your marriage, which I happen to know is a very good relationship, how did it survive writing a book together? Shirley and I would not think of doing that, I'm afraid. And in fact, that's even a greater strain than remodeling a kitchen or something like that.
Let's let Carol answer that. Honey, what would you say?
It really wasn't a strain. It was an enjoyable time, actually. I wouldn't attempt to write on anything else with him as far as when it goes to biblical subjects. But on this particular subject, we've been quite open through our 24 years, and we see the need in many of the marriages of today for these principles and for love and affection towards each other and the real care for each other. And so it was fun just sharing how we felt.
Hmm. Every woman wants what the title of your book implies, Romantic Lovers, The Intimate Marriage. I think if I had to put into one phrase what women desire in a relationship, in marriage, maybe in life, it's in your title. Why is it so difficult to achieve?
Well, that's a great point, Jim, because as you know, romantic novels, even in the secular market, sell like hotcakes. Some of the best-selling books in the history of the world are in that category.
Harlequin,
sure.
Romances and so on.
And as you know, the front cover of our book kind of looks that way.
Yeah, it does.
But I think one of the reasons why it's so difficult to experience that, speaking from a man's point of view, is because we're allowing the world's viewpoint, really, to control us. The world pictures a man who's macho, not too loving, not too romantic. We don't know God's viewpoint. I think that's the biggest problem. And I've seen that in talking to men on a personal level. Men, frankly, have never learned how to love on the basis of God's viewpoint. They're listening to the world about them, and their buddies and friends, and the crass talk of this world is making it a pretty cheap matter to a man.
That implies, David, that you put the larger part of the responsibility for the failure to have a romantic relationship on the man. Do you feel that way?
Oh, absolutely. I believe that 100%, and I know this will be a debatable subject, but I believe that 100% of the success of a marriage rests on the responsibility of the husband rather than the wife. The reason I believe that is because biblically the man represents Jesus Christ and the woman represents the church or the believer. And according to what I read in the Bible, we love because he first loved us. He committed himself to me when I didn't care anything about him. God loved me when I wasn't responding to him. God, in his relationship to us, is constantly initiating the process. And most men need to learn that. How do I initiate the process of loving my wife? And I believe, therefore, they are responsible.
Now, I said something similar in my book, What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women. I laid a large part of the responsibility for that romantic relationship on the man. But let me step out of that role and press you a little bit.
Yes.
Let me act as though I don't agree with that.
Okay.
And I say to you, speaking on behalf of the men who react when they hear that said. I don't know what my wife wants. You can't believe the pressure that's on me. I mean, it's all I can do. I come home absolutely worn out. Mm-hmm. And it may sound easy to say delegate and so on, but the business is teetering on the edge of financial chaos, and it takes every ounce that I've got. Now you tell me that I have to carry this woman emotionally, that I'm responsible for her self-esteem, for her well-being, and for our romantic relationship. And not only responsible, but 100% responsible. I mean, I can preach quite a sermon. What do you say?
Well, I really identify with you, Doctor. Have you ever considered counseling? And by the way, your wife called and she said, no.
You leave my wife alone.
Well, I think what you're saying right now is extremely practical, because a lot of men feel frustrated in this. But, Jim, let me answer as simply as I can at this point and say, I believe that if we knew God's viewpoint, we'd find it's a much easier matter. You see, very few men ever read what the Bible actually says about men loving their wives. There's that familiar passage in Ephesians 5, they hear at a wedding, and you know, they know just a few things. But God actually gave us a book in the Bible about romantic love, about sex and marriage. It's the greatest manual ever written in the history of the world.
I wish we right now could poll our audience and see how many know which book you're talking about.
Yes,
I bet you a lot
right.
would miss it.
Well, it's Hezekiah, right?
Of course.
No, please. But anyway.
Leviticus, great book on romantic
right.
love.
But of course, we're referring to the song of all songs that the genius Solomon ever wrote. The Song of Solomon. And there God has given us a manual. And I have found, Jim, interestingly so, that when men will look at that beautiful song and literally see what it says and how especially the man talks to his wife, their whole attitudes change. But until they see that, they don't know what we're talking about, and they are frustrated, exactly the way you described.
Your book, Romantic Lovers, is a detailed analysis of the Song of Solomon
yes.
as applied to today. Can we really do that? Can we go back those thousands of years and bring that into 20th century North America and apply it to relationships between husbands and wives?
Well, of course, Carol and I really
believe. I'm baiting you. You know
I know.
I agree.
But Carol and I really believe that not only is possible, but is most necessary. We need to say this at this point, that our marriage didn't start out, you know, gangbusters and filled with romantic love. We had similar problems that every young couple faces. And I think what we struggled with was the fact that we were duty-oriented. We did what we believed God wanted us to do for each other in marriage, and I was heavily involved in ministry at the time and frankly ignored my wife. And I began to see from God's Word, when I was asked by a church that I had started to preach on marriage, that's when I began to see that something was wrong in my own heart. And the more I studied God's Word, and I actually developed a series long ago in the Song of Solomon, Jim, I'm telling you, I got so convicted I could hardly stand it. The way I was
right.
talking to Carol, my attitudes towards wow. Carol, and I realized that God has the answers in His Word as to how we can be romantic towards our wives.
Carol, in fact, you refer in the book, I believe, to a quiet tension that existed between you and David. What do you mean by that?
Yes, I was very duty-oriented also. And being a new Christian just shortly before we were married and realizing God's Word was the manual by which we were going to go by and to build our lives and marriage on, as I read that, I decided that I was going to be the best pastor's wife and wife to him as I possibly could be in this new world of Christianity that I had decided to follow. And as I got into that, it became very duty-oriented, not any of my emotions showing, kind of putting them under, and just doing what I knew I ought to do.
In fact, you said, I think, that David was called to the ministry and you were called to be his wife.
Exactly. I really felt that. Being so thankful to God that He saved me and my salvation and all that I have in Christ, and then for Him to allow me to have a Christian husband and one who wanted to serve Him with all of his heart, I felt my call was to serve my husband, and God first and then my husband.
All right, now here's a very important question. We've all talked about commitment in marriage. We've said commitment is the engine on the train. Emotion is the caboose. Emotion will not pull the train. The commitment has to pull the train. What you're saying right now is that you had a very strong commitment to your marriage,
right,
but it wasn't enough.
Right.
So there's something, the caboose is important too, isn't it?
It led to a great deal of inner frustration. Yeah.
And what, David, from your perspective, was that quiet tension concerned with?
Well, I don't look at it as a problem that Carol had, number one. I want to be clear, and I'm not being falsely humble there. I'm just trying to tell you that I knew from what the Bible said that I was the cause. I was the problem. I think the number one thing I saw was that the husband in the Song of Solomon communicates with such sweetness and encouragement and appreciation of his wife. And I have learned in marriage that that's certainly a better way to go than the opposite. And yet most of us are very crass and ugly and sharp and critical and bitter. And yet in the Song of Solomon, he was so sweet. He kept saying such beautiful things about his wife. And I learned that communication was the name of the game, and that most men do not know how to talk to their wives. I didn't. I needed to learn.
You told me before we came in the studio that in your counseling with husbands and wives who do not have that romantic relationship, you sometimes have them read the Song of Solomon to each other in your presence.
Oh,
and
yes.
Some interesting things happen.
Yeah. Well, Jim, the funniest thing that happens is always with the man. Now, gals usually love to do this, of course. It just almost seems like God has uniquely prepared gals to understand romance more than men. But they love to do it. But the funniest thing of all is what husbands do the moment they start reading the Song of Solomon. I would say 99 out of every 100 guys will do this. They start laughing.
They
realize, hey, I don't talk this way, you know. Yeah. And yet in that is the most beautiful opportunity to show that man what's really wrong in his marriage. And most men see it immediately without you having to tell them. They'll frankly say to you, you know, Pastor, I'm not talking like this to my wife. And it's true. If you would read that and read what that man says about his wife and ask any normal American male whether or not he's talking to his wife this way, he's going to say, hey, no way.
It's not normal in this culture for a man to use that kind of language and talk to his wife that way. Yet you see the Song of Solomon as a model for today.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I believe the strongest man in God's economy and program that can possibly be seen is the man who initiates love and is the center and focal point of romance in the home. I do not believe this is a woman's burden. There are so many gals across the country that are suffering deeply in their marriage because they feel responsible to keep the romantic fires going. They're pictured on television as being the key to motivate men. You know, how they dress, how they talk, how sexy they are, and all this is a burden and pressure on women, when in fact, God teaches that the man is to be the romantic head of the home. Mm-hmm. And that's so very important.
He not only talks like this, I mean, as he has put feet to what Song of Solomon says. In our marriage, my children, I am honored in my home, and our children were never allowed to bat talk me, to be disrespectful to me, and sometimes I would feel David was a little hard on them because of this, but they really put me in a place of honor, and because of that, and because of his love for me, they all are looking forward to getting married, and they think it's the greatest thing on earth. Mm-hmm. And he has really stood behind not just the words that the Song of Solomon says, but the actual living day by day. And I know he cares for me. And so that carries on, because it's easy to make love with a man who knows that you know it really loves you.
And
then
I'll pay you later.
Your desire then to elevate him and to admire him and build him up also.
Yes.
It's a symbiotic relationship.
Right.
You know, Jim, our daughter, who, as you know, is married, 2 weeks after the wedding, called me and wanted to have a lunch with me, and I just panicked. I thought, oh, no, they've got problems, because I told her that I didn't want to hear from her for a few weeks. You know, I want those two to get along together, you know. And so she calls me 2 weeks after the wedding, and I'm just panicking and wondering what in the world this is all about. She takes me out to lunch, and she says, Daddy, I am really mad at you. I said, honey, what's the matter? What's the matter? I couldn't think of what I'd done. She said, "You didn't tell me how great marriage was. If I'd have known this, I got married years ago." She's been so excited with marriage. Well, I think a lot of it comes because of Carol's influence in her life. And I believe that the man in the home, and I tell my boys this, the man, the husband, is responsible to be the romantic head of the home. We ought to hear from men the sweetness of Jesus pouring out of their lips. They ought to be complimentary to their wives and showing appreciation and love to their children and family.
Well, let me press you, David. Can you do that consistently? This is a difficult time in your life. You have 4,000 members of your church. That's a heavy responsibility for a man to carry. And writing books and speaking and all the things that you do, you ever just grow weary of being all things to all people and come home too wounded and too exhausted to be what we're talking about here?
Well, Carol and I fortunately have the kind of open relationship where we talk about that all the time, Jim, probably like you and Shirley do. And what I really see the older I get is the more my need of the Lord. Mm-hmm. I need that time where I can be alone and to call out to God and pour my heart out to Him. And I have found, when you ask about being consistent in your home, I see it very much related to my relationship to Him, mm-hmm. to my Lord. Mm-hmm. And if I come home and I'm not reacting properly to Carol, I need to get alone, go out the office and just get on my knees and talk to the Lord about it and ask Him to clear out the cobwebs and put the freshness of His Spirit and His Word into my heart again. I do believe that the ability to be this is directly related to our relationship to God as well as understanding His Word. A thing that I do frequently, Jim, is I read the Song of Solomon. I didn't just write a book and then drop it. I read the Song of Solomon frequently, and I find that going over and over those words deepens my understanding of my responsibility and my ability to respond properly to Carol.
Let's talk specifically about the Song of Solomon. Detail for me what our listeners and Bible readers can expect to pull from that will apply to their marriage to help them become, as your book says, romantic lovers.
Well, Jim, some of the things that we need to say, first of all, is that Christians disagree over the Song of Solomon because Solomon had so many wives. So they wonder whether or not we should trust what's in the Song of Solomon. We have Christians who have written us and said, "Isn't this carnal? This is too much sex talk. This is too erotic."
In fact, Orthodox Jewish families, they will not allow a person to read the Song of Solomon until they're 30 years of age.
That's true.
That's incredible.
As you know, in the book, we give some answers and help to people about this. We believe that Song of Solomon did not have his enormous harem at the time. We believe that the woman of the Song of Solomon is the true bride that God had for him, his one and only, we would say. We believe that that woman is the woman Abishag, who was described as being the most beautiful woman in Israel.
With a name like that, how could she be?
Right. Not Rag, Shag, or
Hag.
Yeah, or Hag, right. But I think that some of that background is important when you relate to the book and what you're going to get out of the book as Christians read it. And hopefully the book that we wrote helps people to understand what's being done and said. Even the order of events in the Song of Solomon is extremely important. We believe that a wedding of Solomon and Abishag occurs in the middle of the book, and then you back up, and the details of the wedding night are discussed, the whole sexual relationship they had, some of the experiences they had where they hurt each other and how they got it restored. All of that is in the book. So it's very helpful if you know what the overall layout is.
You know, your reference to the sexual content of that book reminds me of, Mike, 4 or 5 years ago when we did a program on sexuality and marriage. And in the course of that program, I talked about the relationship between a man and a woman sexually in marriage and how it should be as exciting and as fulfilling and freewheeling as you can make it. Mm-hmm. And I got a lot of mail from people who objected to that.
Of course.
Christian people who said you should never have unbridled passion. It should always be under some kind of check and under some kind of control. And their viewpoint is certainly not supported in the Song of Solomon, is it?
No, absolutely not. The Song of Solomon is the most erotic literature that has ever been written, but it has never been corrupted to the level of pornographic interests of our day. It's never crass, it's never vulgar, it's never ugly. It's always beautiful and romantic, and yet it is the most erotic literature I have ever read in my life. The Song of Solomon is God's viewpoint. It is not man's viewpoint. And the Song of Solomon answers once and for all the question that your listeners were writing about. The whole question is sexual pleasure approved by God? And the Song of Solomon answers with a most affirmative response. Yes, obviously it is. And it's interesting that God teaches sexual satisfaction. And there are a lot of couples who are having sex that, frankly, do not experience the level of satisfaction and contentment that God intended. Why? Because they don't follow the principles that he outlined. Mm-hmm. They're doing it the world's way. And it becomes ugly and crass, and many women suffer deeply because of it.
Just as a physical response rather than as a deeply emotional response.
Becomes more animal-like. And the beauty of romance is not simply for a woman's heart. I'm speaking as a man to you, Jim, as another man, that we know and experience many, many of the same things that our wives do, different at times, but what we do experience is desperately needed in our lives. I need romance. I don't simply need a physical sexual relationship with my wife, as enjoyable and as pleasurable as that is, but I need the depth and the level of romance that God teaches in his word that produces intimate friendship and support.
You know, you refer to the animalistic relationship where it's devoid of that kind of romantic love. As a member of the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography, I saw everything there is to see about sexual relationships. I mean, there was nothing withheld, and it was not erotic at all. Mm-hmm. The amazing thing is that it had very little sexuality in it. It was absolutely gross.
Yes.
Because when it's as it is intended, it has the relationship, the romantic side of it, at the center of it.
Yeah, I'm sure that you need the grace and the love and forgiveness of God in your own heart as you look at all that you had to see.
You know, it's fading, and I'm very grateful for that.
Well, many of us have been praying
for it, and I believe those prayers have protected me.
And I think that a lot of us need to be careful. Also, and this is certainly on the subject, that we need to be careful about what we see and what we read and what we're exposed to, because that'll fight against us in our brains.
Absolutely.
And we will not follow God's advice, and we'll have this constant struggle.
Carol, what help do you get from the Song of Solomon that will make you a better wife?
The being critical of your husband tears him down. And I think that's one of the things that in the Song of Solomon, how she praises her lover. And whenever you tear someone down, it's very difficult to, from your perspective and from his, to have that relationship of oneness. I might just sidetrack here a bit from the book itself. I have in my Bible underlined all the passages where God speaks to women. And that has helped me so much to keep me in line as to what I'm hearing from the world, what I'm hearing on talk programs, what I'm reading in magazines. And I think, yes, I do have my rights. I should go ahead with this, and I'm not going to let him tell me what to do in this area. And this affects it. And in the Song of Solomon, you see how she is completely, her mind is completely involved with his life and what he's doing, and yet he is completely involved with her. So there's this oneness of love.
Mm-hmm. David, there are times in reading the Song of Solomon where you kind of get the picture of a young, starstruck, romantic young man who is perhaps not always going to be in the romantic mood that he was the day that he wrote that. Is the Song of Solomon relevant to those of us who have perhaps passed the 50th birthday or maybe the 60th in some cases? What do your older readers write you about this book?
Well, Jim, the number one letter we get on romantic lovers is from a senior citizen, believe it or not.
Is that right?
And the senior citizens are thanking God that we wrote the book. We have received so much encouragement, appreciation. Many of them say, finally, somebody put God's viewpoint into romance. We have had such wonderful encouragement from them It's been, frankly, one of the blessings to our hearts to see what older people have told us. I think they have lived long enough to see the terrible things that have gone on in society, and they are so thankful that the beauty of romance from God's point of view has been put back into it.
You know what makes that book so incredible from a historical point of view, at least as I see it, is that it recognizes the romantic relationship centuries before it was important culturally. I'm told historically that Shakespeare is the one that popularized the notion of marriage that included romantic love. Marriage was a matter of convenience. It was for purposes of linking one state with another or one principality with another. It was a father selling his daughter to the highest bidder. But marriage based on romantic love didn't come along till about the 1200s. And yet here we have Solomon writing 1,000 years before Christ, who, drawing on that wisdom that he drew from the Creator, recognized how God intended for it to be.
Well, it shows us that the world didn't invent sex, let's face it. God did. And God's manual was in existence 2,000 years or more before Shakespeare. And I think we're all reminded, again, when we look at the Bible, that what we need in our lives is to follow the blueprint of He who designed and invented the whole thing we call sex, love, and marriage.
You know, when you think about it, there you have in the pages of Scripture a window into the mind of God, who is infinite, has all knowledge, all understanding. It's an owner's manual for human experience. And here you have the God who understands all of the science and all of the chemistry and all of physics and all the astronomy and the intricate workings of the human mind, giving us a guideline for how things work best.
Yeah, he might have something to say about marriage, right?
I would think so.
I would think
since
so,
it was
too.
His idea. Well, it's phenomenal, and that's, in fact, why you chose to write a book on the Song of Solomon.
Well, that's certainly the case, because we found in our marriage, Jim, as I know you and Shirley have, that God alone has the wisdom that we need, and we need to seek His face.
David, you've done talk shows on this subject where you've opened the phone lines.
Yes.
That's where people are, isn't it?
Yes, they really are. They're hurting. And you know, Jim, it just occurred to me, listening to what Carol said here a moment ago, I feel for a lot of wives. I really do. They want husbands who are going to love them the way the Song of Solomon says. There's no doubt about that. And I think we need to say a word of encouragement to them. You know, God is a powerful God, and He can change the worst situation. We've seen God do miracles in homes. And I'd like to encourage gals to really call out to the Lord, to really ask Him to speak to their husbands and to break their will, to make them committed to the Lord. And I'd also like to challenge the husbands. Well, you could change your marriage and change your family if you'd learn how to love the way God wants you to love. And I don't mean to imply that gals aren't, but Jim, it has been our experience, both Carol and I, to, and a little bit of a sad experience, to discover that many wives are not crying out to God about their husbands. They talk about it, and they refer to it, but they actually don't do it. And I would encourage gals to really call upon the Lord for their husbands. If the husband is a Christian, naturally if he's a non-Christian, it's a more difficult problem. Her great goal is to see him come to Christ. But if he is a Christian, then he has the Spirit of God within him, and the Word of God will have an impact upon his life. And I have seen men be stimulated by wives who ask them if they could read the Song of Solomon together, just for fun. Let's just do it once. Let's try it. And if they're not obnoxious or pushy or whatever, a lot of guys kind of like that. You know, it sounds like a romantic deal. Great, let's set it up. You know, a little coffee and rose in front of the fireplace, and let's do it. And by the way, Carol and I have tried that many times, and someday, Jim, we're going to finish the book.
You make reference in the book, Carol, to Abishag's low self-esteem. What is said there that makes you feel she lacks confidence in that area?
Her background probably is the comes to her mind that she isn't worthy to be the wife of Solomon, and she doesn't feel that she is beautiful, and yet in his eyes she is beautiful, and She came from the fields and worked in the fields, a farmer's daughter, so to speak, and very plain, and yet Solomon found something in her that was more beautiful than all the women in his courts.
And wasn't there reference made to her brown skin?
As it says, I am black,
yeah,
but beautiful.
In that day, it was not beautiful to have a tan.
Right.
It's interesting how concepts of beauty change.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
White skin then was apparently considered the ultimate beauty.
Oh, of course. Yeah. The ladies of the court were all that way. You know, when Carol was talking here, Jim, it's interesting that Carol's background parallels that a little bit. Grew up in the country and under very difficult circumstances and poverty and all of that. And a lot of problems of self-esteem and self-worth. And so we see the benefit of the Song of Solomon upon our lives tremendously.
It's interesting how Solomon set about building up her self-esteem.
Oh, yes.
So we have that aspect of the relationship, yeah, too, not just sexual, but the emotional aspect of what a man does for a woman. Describe that.
I'll describe it by saying that recently Carol and I were counseling in our home a couple having difficult problems relating to each other, have not had sex for a long, long time, and the man is so arrogant and talking to her so awful, and she blurted out in our presence, and Carol will remember it just happened, she said, how can I make love with a man who talks to me like this? When I look at the Song of Solomon, I see sweet, loving communication that builds people up. And when we ask, how does a person build one's self-esteem? We don't build it by criticism, I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. We build it by showing appreciation and praise based upon certainly facts that the Bible teaches. We don't become hypocritical or manipulative in it, but we say things about the person's inner spirit as well as their outward beauty. We compliment the person for traits that are inside as truly as outside, mm-hmm, and that ministers to the heart.
So he built her up with his words.
Absolutely.
Flowery words?
Well, as you know, Jim, some of these words are pretty flowery. By the way, let me just read you a passage out of the Song of Solomon. I thought it might be of interest. This is the night they're about ready to make love. They've just gotten married. And listen to what he says.
You sure we can get away with this?
Hey, this is the word of God, Jim.
Okay.
Amen. Here's what it says. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse. How much better than wine is your love, and the scent of your perfumes and all spices. Your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna with spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh, and alloys, with all the chief spices, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon. And you ask me, is it flowery?
Hey, David, let's get practical now.
Right.
A man can't talk like that. I mean, most men, would have no idea how to express those kind of thoughts.
Well, I'm not so sure. Let me give you an example. Let's take all he said about her perfumes. Would it not be a sweet thing for a man to say to his wife, honey, you smell terrific? You see, we can make our own vocabulary today and still express what Solomon was saying. The point is that he found things to compliment her. He was noticing.
He
talked to her,
yeah.
Yes. When he told her about her lips dripping as the honeycomb and honey and milk under her tongue, frankly, that's a moist kiss. And he's looking at the beauty of her response to him, as well as the beauty of her outward appearance. He cannot say enough about her. He is focusing on her. And if most men would just change, instead of saying, man, I got a knee, let's hop in the sack, instead, if they would focus on their wives, they would discover how much it ministers to them. Let me tell you something. I love to tell Carol how wonderful she is, because I'm telling you, I am being blessed in the
You're
process.
You're smiling, Carol.
Yeah. Well, obviously it's easy. But anyway, I think men can talk this way, Jim. They really can. Maybe not in the exact kind of words that Solomon used, but we're not focusing on our wives.
We touched on the fact that some Christians, and perhaps many, feel like any kind of unbridled passion, intense sexual pleasure, intense sensual pleasure, even in the context of marriage, is somehow sinful. And you and I both strongly disagree with that, and the Song of Solomon is our reference point. Speak to it. Speak to them.
Well, sexual pleasure, we believe, is under the divine approval of God in the Song of Solomon. And what we do in this book in explaining Song of Solomon is to lay out what we call four basic principles of sexual pleasure. And if I just take a moment to list those, and we can talk about it. Yeah. One is that sexual pleasure is based on the attraction of the husband to his wife. And most men are not thinking that way. They're thinking, oh, no, sexual pleasure is based on how sexy my wife looks. Fascinating, isn't it? As you walk through these, you realize what's really wrong. We're listening to the world. We're not listening to God. Let me repeat that again. Number one is that sexual pleasure is based on the attraction of the husband to his wife. Solomon pictures the sexual delights of his wife in such a romantic way. I mean, he names everything she's got. I mean, he finds something beautiful about her lips and her mouth and her head and her arms and her teeth and everything. I mean, he is enamored with this woman. And men need to learn that. There's not a wife in the world that doesn't want a husband to say, honey, I love every part of you. I often say, and humorously, when we're talking with our kids and all, hey, you got to find why those ears are such a blessing. But that's the first principle.
What's the second?
The second principle is that sexual pleasure is based on the attitude of the wife toward her husband's desire.
What does that mean, David? Are you referring to, and is the Bible referring to, instances where a woman does not respond to the husband's advances? Maybe he has desires that she doesn't share, and therefore she rejects him. What's in that context?
Well, most men are not sexually satisfied, nor do they receive pleasure, if the wife, in fact, is doing this out of duty, obligation, and
that's
isn't responding to his desire.
That's true.
And that's what we mean. Sexual pleasure is based on the attitude of the wife toward her husband's desire. If she does not really want him, he'll know it.
Carol, what do you say to the women who are listening to us who do not have as intense a desire as their husbands, who don't want the sexual relationship as often as their husbands do? And how do they respond to his advances when maybe they do have a headache?
Many times in life we come to things that we don't want to do, but we go ahead and do them. And in the sexual relationship, when you realize that you are making love with your husband and you realize what all is behind it, even you're hurting or you've got a headache or you're just not feeling well at all, and yet you see his need at the time, and to fulfill that need with the love you have for him, not thinking of yourself, and when you give, it comes back to you so richly, and God blesses you for it. And I think after that has happened once or twice in your experience, the next time you aren't feeling good, you recall the benefits of giving to another person.
You know, the world absolutely hoots at that idea today,
yes,
especially the Women's Liberation Movement and those who are of that ilk, that it's not a woman's responsibility to respond when she doesn't feel like it.
Well, actually, it goes both ways. Men are to respond to their wives when they don't feel good,
that's
too.
Right. That's right.
But that principle is very, very powerful. I think if wives really want to reach their husbands, and we get that question asked to us over and over again by Christian wives, if you really want to reach him, then watch your attitude and response toward him, especially when you make love to him. Because men, although they're naive to a lot of things, they know the difference. And if they feel you're just performing, just doing a duty as a wife, but your heart really isn't in it, you're really not responding and enjoying that relationship, he'll know it.
Let's take those other two principles, and then I want to come back to that.
Well, sexual principle number three that we list in the book is that sexual pleasure is based on the acceptance of sexual satisfaction and unity by both husband and wife. Now, Jim, this is very important. When one partner is not responsive, it hurts the overall divine viewpoint of sexual pleasure. God always sees mutual response. Both husband and wife giving to each other in love and enjoying the relationship is fundamental to sexual pleasure.
Hmm.
Can't be just one-sided, in other words.
This is not an ideal to shoot for. What if it's not there? What if we're talking to people who haven't found that mutual relationship? Then what?
God always works through one individual that responds to Him and His Word. They don't both have to do it at the same time. We've discovered over and over again in our own marriage as well as in others that if one partner decides to respond as God teaches in His Word, God uses that partner to affect the other partner to respond back. So it's wonderful when you're both are responding together, and that's the height of what we mean by sexual pleasure. But it starts with one person.
Give me principle number four.
You know, Jim, as we're talking, I have a feeling that you're really interested in this. Sexual principle number four.
Isn't everybody? Hey, you know, the interesting thing, when you speak on this subject, it gets deathly quiet. Have you noticed that? I mean, you mentioned the subject of sex, and you can hear a pin drop on the back row.
Right.
It's an interesting phenomenon, the way we're made.
Well, principle number four is that sexual pleasure is based on the approval of God. And here's where a lot of Christians have struggles. I read you this phrase, which happens to be the middle of this romantic poem, the Song of Solomon. I'm talking about as a Hebrew poem, the middle of it is the climax of their sexual relationship. And we have this voice speaking unnamed. It says, "Eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones." And commentators have argued for years as to who's speaking. Well, there's only one real adequate choice, and that is that God is speaking and telling the couple to enjoy this relationship immensely.
Now, when you call that the middle, you mean precisely in the center.
That's right, 111 stanzas on each side.
Isn't that interesting?
Jewish poetry is beautiful. It's often like an acrostic. Often it's in parallelism. But here's an example where there's some unique features of this Song of All Songs, and I love to talk about it, but the point is that God is giving His approval in the very middle of that book at the very moment they're experiencing their sexual pleasure.
Tell me what kind of things, the very practical kind of questions that people call in to ask you about, and how they fit into those four principles.
Well, they're often embarrassing, to be truthful, Jim, but they explain where people are hurting. We often get asked about questions like oral sex and various forms of sexual pleasure, techniques, methods, all that kind of thing, positions, items that are used, artificial items that are purchased in stores, dressing, undressing, attraction by what we wear and all that kind of thing. And our world is very much into that, as you well know.
And Christians are worried about it.
Yes. And here is where we try to give some sanity to the whole thing. We like to teach that a husband and a wife who are completely committed to the Lord and are seeking to follow His principles, everything goes between the two of them. And what we describe as sexual sin is what God calls sexual sin. If God doesn't say it's sexual sin, then it's debatable. But if God says it's sin, then it's sin. So the things that God calls sexual sin should never be found between a husband and wife. But, Jim, those things are very few, actually. We have a list of all of them in the Bible, and they don't usually deal with the questions that people are asking. When people ask about oral sex, we're not trying to offend people. We don't advocate it or not advocate it. We say that every couple can enjoy each other. If I want to apply oral sex to my wife's ear by chewing it or something, that's my privilege as a husband, as a Christian husband before God. I need to discover whether or not she enjoys that or she doesn't. I want to seek to please her. The fact I'm trying to say is that sexual pleasure is approved by God. And to try to act like it isn't is a violation of what the Bible actually teaches and is going to hurt your marriage.
The problem I've heard about repeatedly in counseling, and I also heard about it as a member of the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography, is where there are different ideas between a husband and wife as to what is desirable and what is stimulating. And a man may read or hear about these exploits that other people are doing and make those demands on his wife.
Well, and there would be an example of somebody not following God.
Yeah.
Because if love was in his heart, he would never do anything to offend his wife. By the way, we suggest in the book that one of the things a couple can do is in a moment when they're not having love and making love with each other, in a moment when they're just talking to each other, and every couple should have a regular time to do that. But when you are, ask your partner, is there anything that I'm currently doing that you do not want me to do that is hurting you? Because I want you to know I love you so much that I would never do anything to hurt you. And another question is there anything you would like me to do for you that I am presently not doing? Because, honey, I want to do anything for you that will bring you pleasure. So now, you see, those kinds of
questions. Focus on the other person.
Right. And that's God's principle of lovemaking. Mm-hmm. You see, when it becomes self-centered and self-gratifying, that's why you get into the problems that you just mentioned a moment ago. Asking your partner that can be an eye-opener.
Carol, you think it's very difficult for men and women to talk about this subject openly?
Not if you started out that way, but I think just if you're going to start like today and you've been married 10 years and you're going to start and you have to work up to it, and it has to be done with a lot of love and concern for the other person. The one who is approaching the subject has to come completely, I think, from the other person's perspective so that he feels involved in what she's saying and that he sees that she wants to please him and that this is something new for them.
Mm-hmm. How does a woman who wants that kind of conversation begin to open her husband to it and introduce that intimacy in the relationship?
By spending time together. David and I have one day a week together. And sometimes if it's an extremely busy week, maybe it's just a breakfast that you'll have together and then a time sitting over coffee talking. And the mood of the conversation, the easiness of being together, you can bring up this subject and just kind of work your way into it. Timing is very important.
Hmm. You make reference in the book to the fact that Abishag desired Solomon and made that known to him.
Yes, she did. And she desired him not only for what he was, but his physical body also. I was thinking as David was reading that passage that as time goes by and your body begins to show the
ravages of time,
of age, that as you make love with each other and as you have this as a foundation, if you can start out with this as a foundation, you become more beautiful in each other's eyes, even though you look in the mirror and you see what time has done. But I think of that song, "You Are So Beautiful to Me," and that is so true. In the eyes of the world, Abishag was not that great, but in Solomon's eyes, she was beautiful.
Doesn't she talk sweet?
Yeah. Is she referring to your body, David?
I sure hope so. I was, you know, that's very interesting. You know, the older you get, when I was younger, I wasn't sure about this. But the older you get, the more you realize how important what we're saying is. I'll tell you, if people cannot talk sweetly to each other as they get old, I really fear for their marriages. Many marriages of older people, we have discovered, have become bitter and ugly and isolated and independent of each other because they never learned to talk to each other sweetly and kindly.
It really is true. And in reading the Song of Solomon, you see just how far we are removed from God's standard. I got a letter the other day from a woman who said that her sex life with her husband was like a silent movie. Oh, you know, there's no conversation and there is some action, but there is no intimacy in the relationship. David, here at the end of the program, talk about the other component to a long-term marriage having to do with commitment. We've talked about the romantic side. In fact, the title of your book is Romantic Lovers. But we also have to be committed lovers. Does Solomon make reference to that?
Yes, he does, Jim. In fact, commitment, as you know from reading what we've written, is what we feel is the bottom line of any marriage. Even when it's not romantic, we're committed. We set a vow. We're going to keep what we said. God holds us accountable for that. But that can be an awful burden when there's no romance and no love in the marriage. But Solomon does say some beautiful things about that, and so does Abishag. And one of the interesting things that you'll find in the Song of Solomon is a particular statement that's repeated three times. I'll read chapter 2, verse 7 as an example. He said, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases." Some translations read it as though it's don't stir up or awaken love until he pleases. We sort of have a a lover here who's sacked out, and she's saying, don't wake him up until he's ready. But actually, it is referring to love making, and so it's correct to say until it pleases. What this is a condemnation of arousing sexual love and passion outside of the marital bond. And that's repeated three times. It's beautiful romantic literature for saying that premarital and extramarital sex is out and forbidden by God. And we go to some end in the book to prove that point, and I think all listeners who are interested in that subject should take a look at what we say, because that is a very powerful statement. Now, you add that with the statements on commitment, and there are three of them. One is, my beloved is mine and I am his, in chapter 2, verse 16. Two, in chapter 6, verse 3, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. And then finally, in chapter 7, verse 10, I am my beloved's and his desire is toward me. And all of that is wrapped up with this beautiful two-verse section, which we have on a plaque in our bedroom in beautiful calligraphy. These two verses, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is as strong as death, jealousy as cruel as a grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. I don't know, to answer your question, I don't know of any stronger statement on commitment that's found in literature on marriage than that one.
Carol, do you think it would be helpful for a husband and wife who want this romantic relationship you've been writing about and that Brother Solomon wrote about a number of years ago to read your book together along with the Song of Solomon? How would you suggest they go about this?
I would suggest that it would be very helpful in if they could set up a time when they're not all uptight about him just getting home from work and her fixing dinner and the kids in bed, but maybe a little retreat of some time, maybe a date, set up a time and a place where they could go through it together and not be interrupted.
And then what? Read a chapter of the book and read from the Song of Solomon?
Jim, we're almost smiling inside when you say that, because most couples who have told us about this book and started out that way have found that they had to read through the whole book the first night.
Is that right?
It's very hard to put this book down after one chapter, because it just is flowing more and more in the areas where we're really concerned about romance and love and sex between husband and wife. Couples are concerned about that, and to get God's viewpoint is truly liberating indeed.
You did write another book together that
received
the Gold Medallion Award, as I recall. Good Marriages Take Time and Bad Marriages Take More Time.
Right.
Great title. That's your title, Carol.
Yes.
Well, we'll have to discuss that one of these days. Great. For today, our time is gone. Appreciate you all being here and making this contribution to so many people who are listening to us. I know this is their desire, to have an intimate relationship. There is something deep within us that longs for a soul-to-soul, heart-to-heart contact with another human being, and especially in the context of marriage. And yet, sometimes it seems just out of reach. And you've helped us bring that within our grasp, and I appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Jim. Thank it's you. Our delight.
And with that, we've come to the end of this conversation between Dr. Dobson and his special guest, Dr. David Hawking, and his wife, Carol. We trust that the program was of help to you, and as always, Dr. Dobson welcomes your questions and comments. If you're interested in other cassettes available from us here at Focus on the Family, simply ask us to send you our helpful cassette catalog. It's absolutely free. Just request a copy in your letter. Now here's where you can write, Focus on the Family, Box 500, Arcadia, California, 91006. And thank you for listening.